You're listening to The Globalist, first brobroadcast on the 18th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the single market. Europe's crown jewel for three decades has its temperature taken. But is it robust enough to withstand today's global challenges? Also ahead, Brazil's president heads to Colombia, talking trade, investment and Venezuela with his counterpart in Bogota. We'll have the latest. Then,
there has been a huge amount of international attention on Iran, and adjacent to that, there has been a real rise in attacks on journalists abroad.
How safe are Iranian journalists working overseas? We'll hear from Reporters Without Borders. We'll take a look at the papers and ask why the UAE can't handle the rain and...
So as Clay puts things together, also Villa Clea, the aim was that put things together and put people together in a way.
We'll have another report from Milan's Salone del Mobile. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The Israeli Prime Minister has warned that his country alone will decide the nature of any retaliation for Iran's attack on Saturday night. Western countries have pleaded for restraint. The United Nations Security Council is expected on Friday to vote on a Palestinian request for full UN membership. And Britain's upper house of parliament has rejected, for a fourth time, a piece of legislation needed to enable Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the EU single market has been described as the crown jewel of the institution. When it was created more than 30 years ago, it was based upon the four freedoms of movement of goods, of people, of services and capital. It was an engine of growth. Well, this week it is being given a health check by Enrico Letta, the former Prime Minister of Italy. In a report that he'll hand to EU leaders later today, he'll warn that Europe needs to be less naive if it is to be robust enough for future challenges. Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Nina Dos Santos, international broadcast correspondent, former CNN Europe editor, and a woman who's worn out quite a lot of shoe leather in Brussels.
Thank you very much. Morning, Emma.
Welcome
what
back.
An introduction,
Nina. Now, let's just establish for those of us who aren't quite across it as much as you are, the single market created in 1993, mm-hmm. and these four freedoms seem to be the perfect way to make European business and consumers' lives easier, from getting a job abroad to moving money to even making sure that the washing machine that you bought in France was going to, you know, work in Germany.
Well, and it was the great success, really, upon which other projects that have made people's lives easier have been built, not least the single currency thereafter, right? If you hadn't have had a single market, with all of the benefits that you just outlined there, Emma, you wouldn't have had the type of lifestyle that many continental Europeans are able to, you know, avail themselves of at the moment. And you wouldn't have had what has become a huge market since it was originally conceived as an idea, concept by Jacques Delors, back in the 1980s, coming into effect in 1993. But essentially, the point that Enrico Letta here, the former Italian Prime Minister, is making is that if Europe wants to continue to be this huge market with sort of a strategic advantage, it needs to get real and realise that there's quite a lot of competition coming from elsewhere. Back in the 1990s, when the single market came into effect, Europe, the EU, as it was then, was less than half of the size that it is now, and bear in mind it's going to grow if it's going to absorb countries like Ukraine eventually. And it also represented about 20% of world GDP. Now that percentage of world GDP is slipping significantly. It's only at 13.3%. At the time, back in the 90s, when the single market came into effect, China was only 5% of GDP. So you can see the landscape has changed radically, and Letta's saying if we don't all get together and row the boat in the same direction, Europe won't be able to compete with the US, China and India, which is growing as well.
It's an interesting idea where the areas of strength have moved, because when the single market was created, there was tremendous criticism that it was highly protectionist, because it enabled everybody within the single market to do business as easily as you would imagine. But if you were trying to import from elsewhere, such as China, that would seem to be a problem. So what's changed?
Well, protectionism does still prevail. And this is one of the problems that Enrico Letta is outlining in this report here. He's saying, well, look, we should actually be more selfish in terms of an EU bloc, but we should be doing it together. We shouldn't allow for these sort of grey areas where important powers like, for instance, France and Germany can avail themselves of certain sovereign protectionist attitudes, particularly when it comes to mergers and acquisitions in the technology space, you know, pharmaceuticals, so on and so forth, preventing other countries from merging across borders. We shouldn't be intra-protectionist with those big countries. Instead, we should be protectionist as a whole, he says, as a whole for the EU as a bloc, if it wants to sort of challenge the rise of other economies. Remember, so essentially what he's talking about here is pooling those. Remember, the EU has very sort of draconian legislation in theory, although it's not very well implemented, on things like state aid. So this is countries, you know, helping to support certain strategic businesses that are either private or semi-private. The EU doesn't like that because it doesn't create a fair playing field for other EU companies that have to compete with those companies. He's saying, well, no, we should pool all of our resources. And yes, we should have some kind of state aid fund, but it should be EU-wide, again, with the focus of competing against places like the United States and others. And remember, this just reflects the current landscape. The EU economy isn't doing terribly well. The United States economy is very strong. Joe Biden has implemented things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which supports all sorts of crucial new technologies, including in the green space. And also this report by Enrico Letta does address that type of thing. He's saying, look, we need to try and invest in these technologies and think as one rather than let selfish interests of individual countries prevail in some cases.
This idea of thinking as one is always the key ideal of Europe, but it always causes enormous problems. And we just need to look at the way that the European Union has worked towards helping Ukraine, that everybody in theory pulls the the tug of war rope equally, but people don't, do they? And if you do have a group of 27 members, how do you make sure that everybody does get a slice of the pie and does pull their weight? Because different countries have wildly different cultures, wildly different economies. This is a perpetual problem.
And wildly different sizes. And we've repeatedly over the years, haven't we, talked about this concept of there being a sort of two-tier Europe, if you like. It came up back in 2008 with the Eurozone crisis, where you remember a number of southern European countries like Portugal and Greece obviously fell into financial distress and had to have help from some of the bigger neighbours. And the counter-argument was always, look, you Germany, don't share your trade surpluses with us. If you have weaker economies that are part of the Eurozone, that is helpful for making sure that your goods and services are competitive, because the currency isn't too strong, isn't as strong as it would otherwise be back in the day when it was the Deutsche Mark. So you've always got this difficult balance between larger countries with large economies and large manufacturing bases as well, which is what Letta talks about in this report. He's saying, you know, the EU should harness its manufacturing base and it should make sure that it supports it all over the bloc rather than just in certain parts of the EU. What he's saying is that, you know, this needs to be evened out between countries. And he's obviously sensitive to that, having come from a southern European country like, for instance, Italy, that often feels left out on some of these issues.
Despite being a very, you know, I think it's the third largest economy in Europe. And these calls that Letta is making, and you said that Europe cannot and should not cede its role as manufacturing leader to others. That's clearly a recognition that actually Europe could lose its place, isn't it?
And manufacturing is crucial for, as you're pointing out, the war in Ukraine, because, yes, going back to what you were saying before about how various member states have sort of talked a big talk you know, claiming they're all on the same side of that rope tugging in one direction. But obviously, not everybody's put their hand in their pocket quite as deep as others. Obviously, this is at the root of that big spat between Germany and France, where the German Chancellor has appears to be at odds with Emmanuel Macron, saying, well, look, you haven't stumped up as much as we have on weaponry. But Europe, if it wants to re-engineer its manufacturing base, it has two ways of doing this to help secure Europe's future, the EU says. One is obviously creating enough capital to boost the defence sector, to make more weaponry, ramp up that weaponry that needs to be made to be sent to Ukraine. Obviously, Ukraine in a terribly difficult situation, as we've seen from what's happened over the last week or so, where they're running out of shells and so on and so forth. And the EU just doesn't have the manufacturing capacity and the capital to plough into its defence sector to ramp up enough of that munitions to get it out east. So that is one opportunity, Enrico Letta is saying. If, you know, you want to create, for instance, a defence bond, a sort of united fund and bond. Ursula von der Leyen is also, by the way, campaigning to be reinstated or re-elected as the European Commission president, with an idea of creating a sort of defence commission or a defence bond to spend collectively on defence to boost the EU's manufacturing capability. Also, green technologies, which is something that's come off von der Leyen's agenda because it's quite political at the moment, and they're facing a push from the far right that doesn't want to invest in these types of technologies. But that, again, is an opportunity for EU manufacturing to be tugging in the same direction, he says.
Now, this idea of everybody pulling their weight together, it extends to an idea to make sure that any country which wishes to join the European Union, the burden of cost is spread a little bit more fairly among existing members. I think just when you look at these claims or these ideas that Letta is having, in theory, they're all great. One wonders, however, in a group of eternal compromise, which is effectively the European Union, whether any of this will actually happen.
Yeah, eternal compromise. Well, let's just face it. Let's acknowledge the realpolitik. Because of the size of the economies and the size of the populations, the Franco-German axis really will steer the debate on this, won't it? And I think what's interesting is that this report is coming out a month and a half before, obviously, those European parliamentary elections that, again, will sort of cement this right alliance inside the European Parliament and various, you know, parts of the EU that govern the EU, like the Council and also the Commission that drafts its laws. And obviously, lots of the conservative voices will be sympathetic to some of these arguments, but some of them perhaps they may not want to embrace. You don't know quite how much from this report the future EU apparatus after those parliamentary elections will actually absorb. But I think you were pointing out about how the EU is going to enlarge. And one of the things that this report is quite clear on is making sure that the EU doesn't just talk a good talk, but actually implements this legislation. And one of the reasons that Enrico Letta is talking about that is because to try and absorb a country like Ukraine with the kind of pushback that there may be with populists gaining ground in places like Slovakia. There was the Croatian parliamentary elections just a couple of days ago, or yesterday, in fact. There may be some pushback against countries like Ukraine that in the past have had challenges with rule of law, corruption and so on and so forth. If they're such a huge market absorbed into the EU, that could radically change the balance on agriculture, on energy. And so Letta is saying, well, if you are going to do this, you also have to get your own house in order and make sure that people are committed for the next quarter of a century and also steering the boat, as I said, in the same direction together. I mean, It's slightly utopian as a vision for the EU. I think you might agree, no?
I'm nodding. Nina Dos Santos, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. You're listening to The Globalist. 7:14 here in London, 1:14 a.m. if you're a night owl in Bogota. Now, Brazil's president is in the Colombian capital, Bogota, at the moment. Lula was scheduled to hold at least 2 hours of meetings with his Colombian counterpart, Gustavo Petro, and other things. And to tell us more about what is on Lula's schedule, I'm joined now by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, professor in international law and international affairs at Birkbeck College here in London. A very good morning to you, Oscar.
Very good morning to you.
Great to have you in the studio. So explain to us, what is on Lula's to-do list in Colombia? What's he doing?
Well, there are three main activities in his agenda. The first one was the opening of the International Book Fair in Bogota. Brazil is the main guest. And when it comes to literature, well, that's very important in South America. But of course, there are two other items in the agenda which are of huge importance. The first one is diplomacy. Lula spoke about the newer threat of extremismo. He used the term both in Spanish and Brazilian Portuguese in reference to the regimes that depend on fake news, disinformation, lies, and as he put it, regimes that negate, deny politics, institutions, and the organization of working peoples. And the third one, hugely important, the setup of an alliance to defend the Amazon, which is the key policy against climate change.
Well, let's deal with each of those in turn. Let's begin with extremismo. What is the threat, and what can be done between Lula and Petro?
There were at least two references there. On the one hand, the better-known cases of Venezuela and Haiti, and they did have a very concrete proposal for Venezuela. They proposed to President Maduro that he sets up a referendum on the day of the elections to guarantee that whomever wins the elections in Venezuela will have its rights and so on respected. This is a very concrete attempt to try and bypass both the sanctions that have been reapplied by the United States on Venezuela, which have proven to be completely ineffective, at least in terms of allowing for democracy to set in, but also to try and push Maduro towards a policy that would not continue what he has been doing so far, which is just sidelining any opposition candidate.
Apologies for interrupting, but
no.
When you have Maduro, who has been ploughing on in his own way for more than a decade now, what is the likelihood of him listening to Lula and Petro?
Well, he has been listening. The only people he would be ready to listen to are his closest neighbors. They also have the biggest influence, perhaps even bigger than the United States, despite the economic levers that our neighbor up in the north can pull. The reason for that is, the simple fact that these countries, these economies, these environments are completely intertwined and integrated. You cannot really become isolated or be isolated in South America. And both Petro and Lula were very clear that isolating Venezuela is a dead end. This is a very concrete proposal. It's a quite innovative proposal, not one that people were expecting.
So we've sorted out that side, but let's deal with the other two as well. You mentioned the Amazon and this creation of an alliance of defence. The treatment of the Amazon has improved, dare we say, since Lula got into power. There is less deforestation. But what does Colombia do Colombia and Brazil do now to ensure that that is maintained?
There were two concrete proposals. The first one is to pool together the resources of the two main fossil fuel companies, Petrobras in Venezuela and Ecopetrol in Colombia, in order to push towards the development of greener sources of energy, in particular green hydrogen. These would be coupled with a very clear plan to finance and fund the protection of the Amazon, and empowering the indigenous communities that live within it. Both Colombia and Brazil have perhaps the biggest Afro and indigenous communities in the region, and they acknowledge the fact that these communities are the ones who can, you know, in situ there en el suelo, they can really protect the Amazon.
And in terms of the way that Brazil and Colombia do business together, and Brazil is Colombia's third largest trading partner,
correct,
who needs who more?
That's an interesting question. I think they need each other greatly. Brazil, because it is often seen by the Hispanic speaking countries as if it were somehow even outside of the continent. But it is so powerful economically and diplomatically. Brazil needs another progressive partner. AMLO in Mexico, but he's a bit too far. Petro is very important because clearly the other target of Lula's statement, the one I referred to before, was Milei in Argentina and also Noboa in Ecuador. We all heard about the way in which Ecuador violated international law of diplomatic premises going into the embassy. That caused a major crisis there.
Finally, let's talk about books. And why Lula is at a book fair is a huge, you know, diplomatic soft power example. But I'm not quite sure what your reading list is up to at the moment. But what will they be browsing and thumbing at this book fair? Who should we all be looking at now?
Oh, let me just give you and our listeners one name: Ailton Krenak.
How do you spell that?
Ailton Krenak, A-I-L-T-O-N, and Krenak is K-R-E-N-A-K. Ailton Krenak is an indigenous spokesperson and has written one of the most beautiful books on how to protect the environment, how to save us from climate change. Again, I keep telling everyone who would listen, the indigenous peoples of Latin America know how to save the world.
Well, you've just done it on the radio. So, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Still to come on today's programme.
We always like to be, even if we're kind of presenting something so different from what is around us, on the other hand, we want to involve people around us and be an example, if we could say in a way, to what it could be like a shared house and a fluid space.
We hear about the latest in furniture design at Salone del Mobile. Stay tuned to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:23 here in London. Let's do today's papers. Joining me in the studio is Claudine Fry, partner at Control Risks. Welcome back, Claudine.
Thank you. Good morning.
How's life in the Fry world?
Well, we're a bit chilly here in London, hoping for spring to come properly into force. But we're very well, thank you.
No chance of that anytime soon. Right, what's in the papers? What have you found?
OK, so the first piece is from the Financial Times. UK trade union law breaches workers' rights, Supreme Court finds. This is a piece about a ruling that Supreme Court here has made, which challenges the government because it asserts that the law as it currently stands relating to workers' rights essentially undermines their right to strike. I picked this one because I think workers' rights are going to be really topical over the next year here in the UK, particularly as we head towards an election season. And the Labour Party, which is, it seems, headed for a victory as things stand at the moment, is going to be making workers' rights a key part of its offering, its campaign, and potentially of its agenda, assuming it comes to power. But I think it's going to be a really contentious contentious one. So this particular ruling is a bit of a blow for the government, which has been trying to make it harder for workers to strike. We've had an enormous amount of strikes here in the UK over the last year or so. And of course, that's the case in other places too. But cost of living issues and others mean that I think there is plenty more yet to come.
There are three parts to this, aren't there? There's first and foremost, these test cases that come along, that you need one individual who sparks the fire. And this is a care worker whose employer suspended her when she became involved in a dispute over a cut to her pay for sleep-in shifts. This is what the FT is reporting this morning. It then becomes a bigger issue of the wider row between the United Kingdom and Europe. I mean, we were talking a moment ago about the single market. Because the United Kingdom has left the European Union, these issues do bubble up quite a bit, don't they? But we also have this third issue that the United Kingdom is regularly brought to a halt by various strikes.
That's right. Yes, and you're right. The Supreme Court has challenged the compatibility of UK law on labour rights with the European Convention on Human Rights. So, yes, absolutely raising that issue of alignment between the UK and Europe now post-Brexit. But, yes, strikes have become highly, highly disruptive, which has undermined levels of public support for them. We all are subject to disruption these days, pretty routinely, if we're trying to use public transport, seek healthcare services, and in the case of children, sometimes their ability to go to school as well.
Let's move on to a story that you spotted in the Moscow Times, which is a protest in Georgia, in Tbilisi, against a law which opponents say will actually bring Georgia more into the bosom of Russia, which is totally against previous aspirations for them to head more towards Europe.
That's right. Georgia is perennially caught between becoming more aligned with the West or staying closer to Russia. And the Moscow Times piece is telling us that tens of thousands of protesters have rallied this week in Tbilisi and other parts of the country to express their anger and frustration as the government is pushing through legislation which they say replicates punitive legislation in place in Russia, which would make it much harder for media organisations and NGOs to operate if they receive any of their funding from overseas. It would require those kinds of organisations who get more than 20% of their money from overseas to be designated as serving the interests of a foreign power.
And when you're working at the likes of Control Risks and someone says, what about Georgia? What does something like this do in terms of the opinion and the knowledge that you're forming?
Yes, it gives us a sense of levels of public opinion about which direction the country should be going in. I mean, opinion polls suggest that actually the majority of Georgians are in favour of being closer to the West and moving forwards towards EU membership, which is something that the country is committed to. And indeed, in December, it was granted EU candidate status. But it also tells us something about the determination of the government to potentially move in a very different direction. Although actually the government has been neutral on the Ukraine conflict, but that in itself is controversial within Georgia. So this is a country which, has some similarities with Ukraine in terms of its strategic positioning, and it's one to closely watch.
Let's move on to an article from the Korea Times. The Korea is investing a very large amount of money in advanced defence materials this year. Explain to us what they're doing and why.
So South Korea has emerged as a really significant player in defence globally. It's a sector which is one of the few which is really booming at the moment in an era of geopolitical turbulence. And South Korea, technologically a highly sophisticated country and one because of its geostrategic positioning, has always taken a very committed and intentional approach around defence for obvious reasons. But it has spotted an opportunity to significantly increase its share of the global arms export market. I think it's about the ninth largest player in the defence industry globally at the moment, and it's targeting becoming the fourth. And this piece is telling us about the commitment specifically to pretty sophisticated high-tech innovation. Artificial intelligence, unmanned and manned systems, semiconductors and robots, and also developing a huge amount of expertise in developing for the industry. It captured a lot of attention in South Korea over the last year because it signed a particularly significant deal with Poland worth about $14 billion.
Finally, let's move to an article in the New York Times that widely reported yesterday about the discovery of a fossil which suggests that once upon a time there was an enormous reptile that was the length of two buses.
Yes, I picked the New York Times coverage of this story because I think it's so lovely that it draws attention to the 11-year-old girl, Ruby Reynolds, who was just walking along the beach one day with her father in southern England and found, yes, a fossil, which it turns out was part of the ichthyosaur, which, of course, was a dolphin-like ocean-dwelling reptile we first discovered about two centuries ago when another young girl, a 12-year-old girl named Mary Anning, was just walking along the beach and made a similar discovery. So, yes, it turns out that this beast was enormous.
I do like the idea that these enormous discoveries can only be made by preteen girls.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, everyone else.
Yes. And also a really nice bit of sort of amateur research, which, you know, Ruby and her father then teamed up with academics at the University of Bristol and elsewhere to put two and two together. But they've been kept involved, which I think is really lovely. The academic at Bristol University who's published a research paper on the discovery has worked with her on his paper.
It's a lovely story, and the quotes are absolutely great when she says, "I found a bit of bone and then I found a bigger bit of bone." Claudine Fry, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. The time here in London is 7:31 a.m. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A look now at the rest of today's headlines. The Israeli Prime Minister has warned that his country alone will decide the nature of any retaliation for Iran's attack on Saturday night. Western countries have pleaded for restraint. The United States, European Union and G7 group have all announced plans to consider tightening sanctions on Iran, seen as aimed as trying to pacify Israel. The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote on a Palestinian request for full UN membership. Israel's ally, the United States, is expected to block the request because it would effectively recognise a Palestinian state. And Britain's upper house of parliament has rejected for a fourth time a piece of legislation needed to enable Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. The legislation is seen by the government as crucial to overcoming existing legal barriers to the scheme, under which the government wants to start sending asylum seekers arriving illegally in Britain to Rwanda to have their claims processed. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, in February of last year, the broadcaster Iran International was forced to cease operations in London because the level of threat against it from Iran and its proxies was simply too much. That prompted the media rights organisation Reporters Without Borders to launch an investigation into the UK, exploring the threats that Iranian exiled journalists face in doing their everyday work. For example, even just last month, an Iranian journalist working for Iran International was stabbed outside his London home, sparking an investigation led by counter-terrorism police. Well, Fiona O'Brien is the UK's Bureau Director of Reporters Without Borders, and she spoke to Monocle's Chris Chermak about the report released just this week. Chris began by asking what had changed for journalists in recent years, since Iran is not a country that has only recently taken to repressive tactics.
No, and it's important to say for context that Iran's repression of journalists abroad, something we'd call transnational repression, has been going on for decades. It isn't in itself something new. It tends to pick up at times when international attention is on Iran. So when there are periods of domestic disturbance, such as in 2017, for example, and a lot of press attention, often we see these spikes in transnational repression as well. We're currently in one of those spikes. So when we talk about a rise, what we're talking about is that since the beginning of the Woman Life Freedom protests in 2022, following the death of Mahsa Amini, there has been a huge amount of international attention on Iran. And adjacent to that, there has been a real rise in attacks on journalists abroad, particularly in London. And I should say that the reason that London is such a hotspot for these kinds of attacks is because there are so many Iranian journalists based here. We have major Persian language broadcasters operating out of the UK, and they have come under increasing levels of threat since 2022.
And now, you say in your report as well that the British government tends to treat transnational repression as something of a foreign problem rather than a domestic one. Why is that in your mind, and when might that change? I mean, is there, frankly, a dark side to this where, you know, somebody would have to be killed on British soil before the government really starts paying attention the way you expect?
I very much hope not. And I do think that we're starting to see this issue taken much more seriously in the UK over the last year or so, which is good to see. I think historically, like I say, this sort of the existence of transnational repression of Iranian journalists is nothing new. I spoke while compiling the report to journalists who'd been here for decades and could tell me stories, you know, going back to the 1990s and before. So I think historically, it has been seen as largely a foreign issue in the sense that it was a matter for foreign policy because the threats were coming from outside. Whereas, of course, while there is a foreign element, it is a matter for foreign policy. It's very much a domestic issue as well, because what we're talking about here is journalists living and working in the UK, many of them British citizens, most of them, and they're unable to conduct their jobs freely and without fear. So it's very much an issue for, you know, the Home Office as well as the Foreign Office, for example. And we'd like to see a much more joined up approach from government, bringing in all those different elements.
Now, you talk about the toll that this takes on the journalists themselves. One aspect of this that I thought was quite stark was, of course, also the harassment of family members. 60% of those you spoke to said that their families back in Iran had been intimidated in some way. Is there anything done about that? Can anything be done about that? I mean, you list all of these personal stresses that journalists are under, but surely that one has to be about the toughest.
Yeah, it's a really chilling aspect of this kind of repression, like you say, and it affects a huge number of journalists. The journalists we spoke to, you know, told us about families being hauled in for questioning in Iran, facing asset freezes, passport removals, all sorts of kind of pressures, job loss even, those kinds of things. Of course, there's also an enormous disruption to family life, because for the journalists here who, you know, are under such threat, that they're not able to travel freely back to Iran. So they're missing out on, you know, weddings and births and funerals. Large numbers of them haven't been able to say goodbye to parents before they died, for example. So it has an enormously detrimental effect. All I should say, the reason that families are targeted is with the aim of getting them to put pressure, instrumentalizing families really to put pressure on the journalists to stop reporting here. In terms of what can be done, it's very difficult, obviously, because that's something that is happening inside Iran. The BBC, you may have seen just yesterday, renewed its urgent appeal to the UN to take action. This is certainly something for the entire international community to come together and condemn Iran and put pressure on Tehran to stop instrumentalizing families in this way. I should also note that while this report focuses on London because of the concentration of Iranian journalists here, this kind of repression is happening to Iranian journalists right around the world. We've done work at RSF in past years, taking testimony from Iranian journalists in the United States, in Sweden, in Germany, France, Netherlands, so all over really. And they experience the same kind of pressures, including that targeting of family members back in Iran.
Well, and Fiona, to broaden it out a little bit, even though this report is specifically about Iran, as you mentioned, the international community there, I mean, this isn't something that only, frankly, Iranian journalists face. And we've seen arguably a certain impunity these days, whether that's, you know, Russia famously, of course, poisoning, targeting opposition figures in the UK, India targeting Sikh separatists in Canada or the US, and things like the stabbing of an Iranian journalist. How has that impacted the expat journalist community in general?
We are, you're absolutely right, seeing examples in other communities as well. You know, this report focuses on Iran, but we've seen plenty of examples of journalists from other countries being targeted too. And I'd also say that one of the tools, if you like, at the disposal of those conducting this kind of repression that has changed in recent years is the possibility of online abuse as well. Huge, just under 90% of the journalists we spoke to were regularly receiving online abuse, and abuse is perhaps too light a word when you think that this includes things like death threats and rape threats and, you know, really horrendous levels of attack online. I think governments have struggled to work out how to cope with this kind of aggression because it transcends borders. but it becomes increasingly urgent because when any journalistic community, you know, be they from Iran, from Rwanda, from Russia, from China, are attacked, press freedom all around the world is affected. Let's not forget that, you know, essentially the reason that Iran in this instance or any other authoritarian government is trying to suppress journalism is because it doesn't want its citizens to get access to free, independent, fair information. And that should be a concern for everyone right around the world.
That was Fiona O'Brien talking to Monocle's Chris Chermak. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's 10:39 in Abu Dhabi, 8:39 in Zurich, 7:39 here in London. Now, what caused more than a year's worth of rain to fall in less than 24 hours yesterday across the United Arab Emirates? And what caused city streets to flood, cars to be washed away and Dubai Airport to cancel hundreds of flights? Well, to hopefully answer all these questions, I'm delighted to say that Mustafa Al-Rawi joins me on the line from the UAE. He's a journalist and writer based there. A very good morning to you. Welcome back, Mustafa.
Thank you. Good morning, Emma.
So these scenes were breathtaking yesterday. I think many of us didn't quite believe that they were happening. What was it like?
So you would have seen the videos on social media. Everyone would have seen the kind of the floods, the torrential rain and the impact on infrastructure and the delays to everyday life, business, schools, you name it. It's been a disruption this week ever since what was essentially more than double an annual rainfall falling within a 12-hour period across the country. And in particular, Dubai's infrastructure was hit pretty badly. And you asked the question, you know, why? Why did this happen? And I think more broadly, it is a climate change story. It is an essence that more rain will be coming and has been coming. And there needs to be a resilience built in across the UAE to handle that change that, you know, as we say, unprecedented, as you say, unbelievable scenes, then we know that for a fact. We have to ensure that the investment is made over the coming months and years to make sure that this disruption is never felt like this again.
Indeed, because normally one would consider the UAE to be a place which gets things right. It gets things done quickly and it gets things done well. But when it comes to resilience, this seemed to be a corner of the world which was taken entirely by surprise in terms of its level of readiness.
I think the point you make about getting things done and getting things done quickly does have another side to it. And if you do build up a what is a world-class city in a very short period of time, say under 20 years, then you're not going to be able to get everything in place. Now, the UAE and Dubai has a really good track record on infrastructure, but there are, you know, limits to the scale of that. So yes, you can build buildings, you can build communities, you can build airports and roads, but then, you know, the sewage system and the drainage system that's required for one particular climate isn't necessarily going to be fit for a very different climate. So yes, you can build things quickly, you do get things done. And certainly there is a little bit of, I think, Schadenfreude in terms of people looking from the outside at the region. Dubai has been on the rise, the UAE has been on the rise. To see these scenes is almost like, well, things aren't perfect there either, tends to be a little bit of the flavor, I think, of the coverage. But yes, to get back to your original point, this is historic. Since records began in 1949, there has not been this much rain in this period. And if this is going to be the norm over the coming years, then what the UAE does, what Dubai does, and what the wider region does, because we shouldn't forget there were deaths in Oman, this rain hit Saudi Arabia. So it's not just the UAE, but a regional thing for a typically arid region to now expect more rainfall than usual is a very, very big factor in how things should be done in the years to come.
And what is already, I mean, once the mopping up is done and the clearing up is done and the planes are taking off again at Dubai Airport and across the region, has there been any indication about what changes will be enacted to the infrastructure of places which for so long have not been troubled by this?
I mean, there's a lot of frustration. I mean, we're in the middle of it, like you quite rightly point out. And I was speaking to several business owners over the last couple of days, and you know, there's lost revenue, and it could have been a lot worse. I mean, let's also be honest about that. I mean, given the way that the UAE responds to things, that they managed to limit the situation, but it was still pretty bad and probably won't get back to normal till next week. So what do you do when you're disrupted for 5 or 6 days? So there's frustration. There's a little bit of annoyance that there wasn't enough done in advance, but certainly it feels as if this particular incident, this particular storm that came in off the Indian Ocean, and if it's expected to happen again, will be the moment that authorities and the people who make these decisions realize that things have to be different now. So we haven't seen exactly what that is going to look like, but you would expect that they won't want a repeat of this again.
Indeed. And how much trust is there in the authorities that this can actually be done and you know, that changes can be made effectively?
I mean, trust is relatively high, and particularly if you compare it to Western countries, culturally, socially, economically, there's a lot of trust in what's happening. But also, communication isn't always effective. So we had an incident maybe a month ago. There was another storm coming, and there was a huge wave of communication in advance. Almost they over communicate, and everyone was ready and braced for it, and never quite materialized. This time, the communication wasn't at that scale in advance. People weren't warned to that level. And maybe there was some complacency because of what happened last time. And so I think certainly what I expect is the next time a storm is coming, there will be an over-communication. There will be things made clear to be ready, that everyone should be prepared, that you should limit your movement. Businesses should be ready for disruption. But it's going to take time to build in that resilience. And you need money and you need a plan. And there are many, many projects going on at the moment that will need to build that in going forward. And we'll see what that looks like in the next few months.
Mustafa Alwari, thank you so much as ever for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Time now to get the latest Nordic news from Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov, who joins us on the line now. A very good morning to you, Petri. How is Helsinki?
Good morning or hyvää huomenta, Emma. Helsinki is quite chilly this morning. It's only about +1, so, but I'm, of course, in a cozy, warm studio, so it's all good.
Thank you for bringing us that vital update. Let's head to the Baltic region, to Lithuania, to get the latest on a very big deal that's happening between the Lithuanian government and the German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall.
Yes, that's correct. So this week, the Lithuanian government signed a memorandum of understanding with Rheinmetall to build a factory that would construct 155mm ammunition. And this will be one of the largest investments ever made in the Baltic region for an armaments factory. And of course, the background to this is that the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, have been very vocal in their support for Ukraine and also calling for a European weapons and ammunition manufacturing in support of Ukraine, and of course also supporting their own defense. So it looks like they're not only talking but actually walking the walk as well, and will start producing ammunition.
This is a big deal, isn't it, for the Baltic region?
It is a big deal, and it's a big deal also for Europe, because it shows also sort of all this talk about Trump presidency, a potential Trump presidency, what it means for NATO. It's a big deal also for Europe's self-reliance in manufacturing ammunition.
It also explains a little bit about the way that that Europe's economy is shifting. It is obviously, as you mentioned, anticipating an uncertain future when it comes to Europe's relationship with the United States, depending on what happens in November in the elections. But it also is that pivoting back to more traditional manufacturing of a kind that perhaps post-war many people thought we would never see again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is one of the reasons behind this decision. As per the Lithuanian government, they say that they want to reduce their reliance on what they call extended supply chains, and they want to ensure a long-term supply of ammunition. Of course, then by sort of partnering with Germany and Rheinmetall to produce it instead of buying it from somewhere in Asia or the US.
Let's have a major change of direction, Petri, which is what we do so well here on Monocle Radio. Let's forget about what we've been talking about a moment ago and talk about an invasion of bears in Finland.
Yeah, I could almost do a segue here and talk about the Russian threats, since in Finnish we call them the Russian bears. But let's not go there now. Let's be civil.
You've just done it, Petri.
Yeah, I might have. But basically, so this week this has been all over the news. So there have been several bear sightings near Finland's second city, Tampere, which is quite, you know, it's in the south, not far north of Helsinki, and we've used to seeing the bears close to the Russian border, sort of further in the north, but now the brown bears that Finland has, the large bears can weigh hundreds of kilos. They've come now down south in search of food and nutrition, and they've been, as I said, there have been sightings near people's homes close to this big city of Tampere. So you know, I'm a little bit worried being here in Helsinki. Will they come this far south? And what do I do if I see a bear? Do you have any tips, Emma?
No, I haven't the first idea. I'm in the middle of London, Petri, but I have the internet. But the issue is that there's a growing number of bears, and there's also fewer permits to get rid of them. Maybe you should get a large gun.
Or maybe I have one already. No, but just kidding. So sort of just a very brief background to this. So Finland, the bear population in Finland almost went extinct. And then, this is decades ago, and then they started protecting them. And now it looks like the preservation has been so successful, actually, that there's too many of them. But then people still are sort of, they are wary of the history. They remember that they almost went extinct. So whenever the hunting licenses go up, then there's a large opposition to it, saying that, hey, look, you know, we need to remember that we almost killed them all. But now this is sort of the unexpected side effect, that they're venturing down south looking for food.
Petri Bertsov, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. And you're listening to The Globalist. And Villa Clea is a new art space and residency located in southern Milan. It's the brainchild of husband and wife Matteo and Alina Corbellini. Both of them have a background in architecture. The former car repair garage has been given a complete overhaul, dominated by materials such as clay and cement. And this week, the villa is showcasing a furniture system called Luna, developed by Alina and originally conceived to answer the real need of furnishing the space where the couple also live. Matteo spoke to Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, at our House of Switzerland pop-up studio at Salone to talk about artist residency plans and opening up his home to the creative community.
Villa Clea is a fluid space, is an architecture that I designed and also partially built together with a team that is in the south of Milan, close to Fondazione ICA and Fondazione Prada. And
it's near where the new, fairly near where the new Olympic Village is, the Scala Putzermann.
Exactly, yeah. It's near where a lot of things are changing, but it seems in a good way. So we're really happy about the evolution of the neighborhood. And yeah, Villa Clea, it's kind of a particular space because it's surrounded by a lot of buildings that are kind of 8, 7, 9 floor around, but we're on the ground floor, and it's a floor-to-ceiling building where, like, it was kind of an opportunity for us to have a building like that. And in fact, before it was a car workshop, it was an unused, abandoned car workshop, and no structure, no foundations, the roof was falling apart, so
I... So a little bit of work.
Exactly. I had to demolish everything. I kind of reused the maximum I could do for, like, rebuilding the new foundations. So I used reused materials for the foundations, and then everything was built from scratch, and it's this kind of monomeric building made of cement, clay, and chalk. So that's also why the name Clea, that in Italian doesn't mean nothing, but on the other hand, as a kind of like root on clay in English and also other languages, that cl, it's like a proto-Indian way to say something that puts things together. So as clay puts things together, also Villa Clea, the aim was that put things together and put people together in a way. But coming back to the opening, these days Villa Clea is open to host the first 4 artists we had in residency, and also to show the Luna collection that just been launched. So Luna is a collection that Alina, that she's also my wife, designed for the house. It's basically everything is made in aluminium, in raw sheets of pure aluminium. As I used almost one material to build the whole house, she decided to use another time just one material to do all the furnitures of the house. And first of all, I mean, she has a background in architecture as me, but she doesn't feel herself as a designer. But on the other hand, she imagined to have like these super, super essential and clean furnitures for the house. So it naturally happened that she designed it and she produced it. And then now it's a collection available for everybody that is interested.
And you mentioned your architecture background and the fact that you use clay and cement cast. But, I mean, it sounds like beyond having a background in architecture, you got extremely hands-on making this place now.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was really an occasion to find a building that needed a lot to be as it is now. And so I was inspired, even if everybody around me, even almost Alina, was kind of, what are we doing? Is it really like the place where we can go and live and work and invite people? But for me, it was really the occasion to make a building that could shift completely from what it was to how it is. But on the other hand, not just appearing as a new for in the city, but also being connected with the neighbor and the surrounded. So, in fact, the first opening, real opening we did of the building was with the neighbor. And so, yeah, we always like to be, even if we're kind of presenting something so different from what is around us, on the other hand, we want to involve people around us and be an example, if we could say in a way, to what it could be like a shared house and a fluid space.
And what made you want to do this? You said that it's also where you live. What made you want to sort of actually live in this in this villa, this residency? And how, what form will it take in terms of how much interaction is there going to be with the artists? Is the plan to sort of have a very close interaction with them?
I think me and Alina, we were going out from an art residency we did together in 2019 as a duo, and we were really thinking, let's find a place to make a studio house. But then it arrived all the moment of COVID, where everybody was kind of closed in his own private space. And I think for me, during that moment, I really felt, and Alina completely shared from the scratch with me, the fact that we wanted to have not only a space for us to work, but also a space that was constantly in evolution and with different people passing. So that was probably one of the first movement of conceptualizing the spaces. And yeah, with when an artist come, I mean, none of the space of the villa, let's say, is, I call it room. I call like space one, space two, and space three. And one artist has one space, we have another one. The other one is the space where the artist can live together with us. In fact, it's not a productive residency because we don't ask precisely to the artist to produce artworks over there, but we kind of propose a different setup for an exhibition of works he did or recently or in the past, or he made on purpose for the Villa Clea experience, or sometimes we had live performers, and in that case, of course, you have to do something over there, but it's a space where you can really like relax, rethink, and give, living the atmosphere that it's completely being in an oasis in a city. And so for the artists, I mean, the first four we had, they were super happy, and I think they were super enthusiastic, and the work they presented or they did for the space was super related to the environment.
That was Matteo Corbellini there talking to Ed Stocker at Salone del Mobile. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to our guests and to the producers, Laura Kramer, Chris Chermack and Monica Lillis. Our researchers were George Ruskin and Gunnar Grunlid, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Flynn Simons. After the headlines, more music on the way and the briefings live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.